This is our third study in the life of Daniel, taken from the first six chapters anyway, when we are particularly concerned with the conflict that Christians face, or the conflict, to be broader, the conflict that the people of God face in a world that doesn't share their standards, and how they behave when the pressure is on. We've looked at the pressures that were upon Daniel and his friends in chapter 1, and then we saw the conflict between the kingdom of God and the kingdoms of man in chapters 2, 3 and 4, and now we look at a conflict of loyalties in chapters 5 and 6. But the story has moved on considerably from chapter 4. Nebuchadnezzar has died. The opening story, if you can recall, happened in 605 BC, when Nebuchadnezzar first attacked Jerusalem and took the people, or the best of the people, the leading youths of the upper crust families, he took them into Babylon to train them to be courtiers and administrators. That was in 605 BC. But time has moved on and Nebuchadnezzar has died. He was succeeded by a man called Nabonidus. But Nabonidus spent most of his reign in the country regions, not in Babylon itself. And the control of Babylon, or the control of the administration of the kingdom, was very largely in the hands of his son Belshazzar. So Belshazzar was actually the second ruler in the kingdom. His father Nabonidus in the country areas was the official head of state, but Belshazzar was really the man who ran the kingdom. So he's called King Belshazzar. And later on you'll get a reference to his rewarding of somebody, and he says, "I'll make you the third ruler in the kingdom." Because his father was first, Belshazzar was second, and this next prize was to go to the slot after Belshazzar. But as you read chapter 5 through, this is the story of Belshazzar's feast, you find at the end that Belshazzar is slain, and that the Babylonian Empire crumbles, and it falls under the Medo-Persian Empire. That's the end of Babylon. And the year is very well known, 538 BC. So just doing a little mathematics. Let us assume at the very youngest, Daniel was 15 when he was first taken as a youth in chapter 1. Supposing he was 15 at the youngest, we are now, from 605 through to 538, we are now 67 years further on. So 15 plus 67 equals 82. At the very youngest, Daniel is now 82. And of course he's older than that in the next chapter, which is the story of the lion's den. And just another couple of points here before we get going on the lesson. You're going to find that sometimes the story refers to Nebuchadnezzar as Belshazzar's father. Now everybody knows that Nebuchadnezzar was not Belshazzar's father. Nabonidus was Belshazzar's father. But quite often in the Old Testament, the ruler is referred to as the father and his successor is referred to as son. And this is common, not only in relation to kings, but also in relation to prophets and in the New Testament, where the leader calls his offsider, or the person who follows him, he calls him his son. So sometimes it talks about Nebuchadnezzar, your father, and Belshazzar being the son. So Nebuchadnezzar is the father solely in the sense that he was his predecessor as king. And another point, you're going to meet a woman called the queen, who happens to be the queen mother, and most likely that is Belshazzar's mother, who is the wife of Nabonidus, the husband, who happens to be out in the country regions controlling the far-flung provinces. Well, that clears the ground a little. We can now move on and get the drift of the story in chapter 5. I think you're fairly familiar with it, Belshazzar's feast, verse 1. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of the 1,000. In verse 2, when he tasted the wine, he commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver, which Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem, be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. So it's a feast, and it's not only a feast of great drunkenness and revelry, but it's a feast of great contempt for Jehovah, rubbing salt into the wound. Those sacred vessels which were there in the house of the Lord in Jerusalem and which had been brought into Babylon and placed in the temple of the Babylonian god, these are now taken and deliberately used in this feast as an act of contempt against Jehovah, because in verse 4 they fill these vessels with wine and they praise the gods of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood and stone. Every god they can think of. They know that the Israelites don't believe in any idols. And so here deliberately, all the idols they can think of, whether they're made of gold or of silver or wood, iron, stone, anything, they praise every god they can possibly think of, using the vessels out of the house of Jehovah to drink their toasts to these gods. So it's an act of outright blasphemy, flying in the face of Jehovah. Belshazzar is letting Jehovah know what he thinks of him. And then you know the story that mysteriously, at the height of the feast, when all the lords and the women and the harem women and all the people that they had got there, at the height of the revelry, this mysterious hand appears and it writes this wording on the wall. We know that the king is shocked, he's overcome with terror, and he tries to get his wise men to interpret it. The wise men can't. And then Daniel is called in. Now he doesn't seem to know much about Daniel. Well, that's well explained by the fact that after Nebuchadnezzar went, Daniel could have retired, and at 82 years of age you don't expect him still to be in the government service. He may have lost his position with the new regime, he may simply have retired. But Belshazzar's mother knew of Daniel, even though Belshazzar himself wasn't too familiar with events. And so Daniel was called in to interpret this mysterious writing. And notice Daniel's boldness, quite different from what we've seen in the previous stories, where Daniel seems to have had a very gentlemanly approach. Even though he was in conflict, he seems to have had a fairly gentlemanly approach. But this time, he doesn't mince words at all. He rips right into Belshazzar. Verse 17. Belshazzar had offered a reward if anybody could interpret this mysterious writing. Daniel said, "Let your gifts be for yourself," which sounds very polite, but he said, "You can keep your gifts and you can give your rewards to somebody else. But I'm going to read the writing and I'll tell you what it means." And he goes on in the next few verses to remind Belshazzar of what had happened to Nebuchadnezzar. The story we had this morning of the great tree chopped down and Nebuchadnezzar goes and eats the grass of the field. And then he says to Belshazzar, looks him straight in the eye, and in verse 22 he says, "And you, Belshazzar, you have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this, but you have lifted up your heart against the Lord of heaven. The vessels of his house you have brought before you, and you and your lords, your wives, your concubines, you've drunk wine from them, and you've praised the gods of silver, and the gods of gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know, but the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways, you have not honored. You haven't learnt the lesson that Nebuchadnezzar had to learn the hard way. You've known all this, and you've treated God deliberately with contempt. You took no notice. So, Belshazzar, here is the judgment." Whatever the words were, we're not quite sure. However they were written, it could have been in some acrostic fashion, or they could have been arranged in some form. But anyway, Daniel made some observation of what these words meant. And he came up with three words, Mene, Tikal, and Perez. Concerning the Perez, although he says Perez at the beginning, or rather he says Parsin at the beginning, he interprets it as Perez later on. It's a simple change. Perez is singular and Parsin is the plural. In some of the ancient versions it used to say Mene, Tikal, Upharsin. In more recent versions it will say Mene, Tikal, and Parsin. And the explanation of that is very simple. In Hebrew the word "and" is "you," written in English anyway as "you." So that is the "and." And when you put "you" in front of a P in the Hebrew language, the P adds an H to it. Similar to in English, if we have "a," the indefinite article "a," and it comes before a consonant, you just say "a bat." But if it comes before a vowel, you change the "a" to "an." An ark. Well, in Hebrew, it's "you" before any other word, but if the word starts with "p," the "p" changes to "ph," so it becomes "you farsin." That's just a simple explanation so that you know why different versions have it written different ways. So the three words then are Mene, Tikal, and Perez. And you know the interpretation. Mene, numbered. God has numbered your days. God has fixed the days of Babylon's collapse. Tekel, weighed. God has weighed you, God has judged you, and he's found you a failure. Perez, divided. God is taking your kingdom from you, he's dividing it up, giving it to the Medes and the Persians. And that night, verse 30, Belshazzar the Chaldean king was slain. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. We all know that Cyrus, the king of Persia, was the overall commander. Apparently, Darius was the Median leader, who was, of course, under the overall command of Cyrus. That's just a minor detail. Let's leave it there for a moment, please. We'll come back directly, but can you flip back to Isaiah 21? Now, what I want to do here is something similar to what I did in my first talk, where I combined a passage from Isaiah with the things we're reading about in Daniel. Now, once again, we have the overthrow of Babylon referred to in this passage in Isaiah 21. One or two small details. Towards the end of chapter 5 we just read, it talked about the Chaldean, meaning of course the Babylonian. Throughout the Old Testament, Chaldea is Babylonia. Ur of the Chaldees means Ur in Babylonia. Chaldea and Babylonia, by and large, you can say refer to the same area. Likewise, Elam and Persia. You'll meet Elam from time to time in the Old Testament. It was the ancient name for what later was called Persia. Chapter 21 is an oracle or a message from God, and it concerns the wilderness of the sea, something full of unrest and turmoil and chaos. It's a reference, as you read through, it's very clear that he's referring to Babylon. The vision that he has is of the Medo-Persian army preparing for the final assault on Babylon. That is what we just read in Daniel chapter 5, because that was the day on which Babylon fell and the Medo-Persian army took control. The prophet here foresees that event. He starts off with a very graphic picture in verse 2 as he sees these Medo-Persian soldiers assembling for this attack on Babylon. A stern vision is told me in verse 2. The plunderer plunders, the destroyer destroys. The plunderer and the destroyer, of course, is Medo-Persia. As he says, go up, O Elam, or Persia, lay siege, O Media. Go up and attack Babylon, he is saying to the Medo-Persian forces. All the sighing she has caused, I will bring to an end. All the sighing Babylon has caused, I am going to bring to an end, says the Lord. All the trouble she's caused, all the heartache she has caused, all the suffering she has caused, at last I am going to bring it to an end, says God. The prophet then has a vision of the overthrow of Babylon, and it is terrible. So frightful that he doesn't really want to look at it. Now, he had always longed for the destruction of Babylon. Why shouldn't he? To get rid of those people who are oppressing the Israelites. He'd always longed to see them overthrown. But now that he actually sees it happening, he gets no joy in it. He takes no delight in seeing Babylon minced up, in seeing the slaughter and all the rest of it. His mind is filled with horror, and he turns away from this dreadful sight as he pictures the coming onslaught. And so he's not out for vindictiveness, he's not out to get square, he's not out for his pound of flesh. Of course he wants Babylon crushed, of course he wants Israelite released. And yet when he sees it, the tenderness of his heart can't help but express itself as he almost turns his eyes away and says, I wish I didn't have to witness this. And so he says in verse 3, my loins are filled with anguish and pangs have seized me like the pangs of a woman in travail, and I'm bowed down so that I cannot hear, and I am dismayed so that I cannot see. My mind reels and horror has appalled me, and the twilight I longed for has been turned for me into trembling. The great day of liberation that I longed for, he says, the edge is taken off it, the shine is taken off it. I'm turned to trembling as I see the suffering that it causes. Don't get the idea that these Israelite chaps were all a bunch of bloodthirsty characters that wanted to see all their enemies crushed into the ground and trampled into pulp. Here we see the compassion of this man's heart as he contemplates the dreadful destruction to come upon even his enemies. And then the scene shifts, and he pictures now those men at Belshazzar's feast, there in the capital city Babylon, verse 5, preparing the table, spreading the rugs, eating and drinking, the great feast of Belshazzar. And then right in the middle of the feast, arise, O princes, oil the shield. In the middle of the feast, they are called to defend the place, which again is what happened in Daniel 5. That very night, the Babylonians attacked and Belshazzar was slain. So that's another brief picture. Verse 6, you get another brief picture. This time, it's as if he is sending a couple of watchmen to Babylon to report on what he sees. You see, he's seeing the fall of Babylon in pictures. He's foreseeing it. It hasn't yet happened, but these are the visions that he sees. And of course, they all tie in with Daniel chapter 5. This time, he sees a vision. And in this vision, he sends a watchman to Babylon to report on what he sees, because the prophet is some other place. Then the watchman comes back, and he tells him what he sees. We'll read it, verse 6. The Lord said to me, go set a watchman, and let him announce what he sees. And when he sees riders, horsemen in pairs, riders on asses, riders on camels, let him listen diligently, very diligently. Because when you see those riders on those animals, you know that the enemy is preparing for the attack. So listen very carefully. The day is approaching. Well, then in verse 8, he who saw cried, that is the man that he sent to Babylon to report on the proceedings, cried, upon a watchtower I stand, O Lord, continually by day, and at my post I am stationed whole nights. And this is what I see, verse 9. Here come riders, horsemen in pairs. The enemy is approaching. The Medo-Persian army is approaching Babylon to attack it. And he answered, fallen, fallen is Babylon, and all the images of her gods he has shattered to the ground. The gods that Belshazzar sang the praises of by using the golden vessels out of the house of Jehovah, those gods in verse 9 are now shattered to the ground, and Babylon, magnificent Babylon, is fallen. And in verse 10, a note of refreshment for the Israelite captives. O my threshed and winnowed one, those Jewish captives who had been trampled on, harrowed, threshed, winnowed, walked over, persecuted and suffered, he says, O my threshed and winnowed one, what I have heard from the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, I announce to you. It is true, I am telling you, Babylon is about to fall, and you are about to be released. The twilight that we longed for is coming at last. Now, back, if you will, to Daniel chapter 5, or Daniel chapter 6, rather. I just tie those two things together, Isaiah 21 and Daniel 5, to give us, again, a glimpse at the very same incident from a different viewpoint, from a different writer, and from a different era. But they both add up to the same thing, don't they? That you cannot defy God and treat him with contempt and expect to get away with it indefinitely. Sooner or later, Babylon will fall. Now we come to chapter 6. Daniel was rewarded, but he didn't have all that much time to enjoy his newfound rank under his existing masters, because that night Belshazzar was slain and a new government came into power. It was now the Persian Median government. Daniel was rewarded, and in spite of his great age, he was now restored to rank in the kingdom. He was made one of three presidents who ruled. Verse 2 tells us about those. Daniel was one of three presidents whom the new emperor appointed. He was a man of great ability. And as usual, ability can be a dangerous thing, because people who don't share that ability will get jealous. And that's exactly what happened. It happened there in Daniel's day, and unfortunately it's still happening today right through the world, and it's even happening in churches. It's sometimes dangerous to be better at something than someone else, because it stirs up that horrible old thing called jealousy. Well, these other two presidents, they got jealous. And they thought somehow they would have to pull the rug from under Daniel. We'd have to get him tripped up somehow. We'd have to do the dirty on him, some skullduggery, something to chop him down. Unfortunately, they couldn't find anything wrong with him. However, they knew that he was a godly man. And they said, what we'll do is something that will be concerned with his religion. We'll get a law that will be against his religion, so that if he keeps following his religion, it will involve him in breaking the law. And then we'll have a chance to nail him on something. So in verse 5, these men, after they could find nothing wrong with Daniel, they said, we will find no ground against him unless we find it in connection with the law of his God. Well, you know what happened? They created this law whereby they said any prayer that was offered to any god whatever could be offered, provided it went through the king as the sort of god-king figurehead of the nation. Now, that was a fairly common Persian custom, and the king agreed to it. It was also very flattering, and he didn't knock back any opportunity to strengthen his own position as head of the nation. Well, of course, it caught Daniel. These men, when they put the proposition to the king, conveyed the impression that Daniel agreed with them. Daniel, of course, found out later, after the deed had been done. The act had been written, it had been sealed, it could not be changed, and then Daniel found out about it. Well, you, of course, know what happened in verse 10. When he knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house, where he had windows in his upper chamber open towards Jerusalem, and he got down upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as he had done previously. They're the words I want to bring your attention to. As he had done previously. He simply ignored the law. He didn't set out to do anything extra special. He didn't do anything that he hadn't done before. He just kept on going the way he'd always gone. And he ignored this new law. Well, of course, he was accused and he was sent to the den of lions. The king did so very reluctantly because the king had a lot of time for Daniel. He was impressed with him. But unfortunately, the king had made the law and there was now no way around it. We know, of course, that God delivered Daniel, showing that the type of religion, the type of worship that God approved of, was not the state-controlled worship that the king had been promoting, but Daniel's simple, honest style of worship. And so God vindicated Daniel. Now let's see how Daniel acted when he had this conflict of loyalties. We notice that he refused to sin against his conscience, even though it brought him into head-on conflict with the state. Notice also that he plotted nothing against the king. Nevertheless, he refused to obey. Not only did he refuse to obey, but he was prepared to take the consequences. He didn't refuse to obey and then try to wriggle out somehow and try to justify the law or some other way. He said, well, that's the law. I'm not going to obey it, and I'll just have to take the consequences. That's what the three men did in chapter 3, wasn't it? The same type of thing. Another thing worth noting here is that Daniel didn't in any way try to retaliate against the people who'd rigged the system against him, his enemies. He realized, as all of us must realize, that vengeance belongs to God, and he will repay. It's not up to us to take the law into our own hands to get square with those who have ill-treated us. And above all, Daniel had faith. He trusted God. That is told us in Hebrews chapter 11, where Daniel is mentioned, though he is not named, by faith God shut the lions' mouths. And there was another spin-off, which we mustn't forget, through all of this. He led another person to a knowledge of God. Now, just how much this man was a Christian, if I can use that expression, we don't know. But there's no doubt that it led this man to at least some knowledge of the one true God. You find that in verse 26. After this is all over, the king comes out and he makes pleasant comments about the God of Israel in verse 26. I make a decree concerning fearing the God of Daniel, for he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, and he has saved Daniel from the power of the lions. It's great to see the bonus, isn't it? that the man stands firm for no other reason than that he stands firm, because that's God's will, and he's not going to deny his God. So he stands firm, but at the end there's this bonus. Another person comes to a knowledge of God. Daniel is one of those people of whom it is said later on, they shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, those who turn many to righteousness. And here was Daniel, a person who had turned someone to righteousness, and of him he shone like the stars forever and ever. That's a great verse. That's Daniel chapter 12, verse 3. It's an interesting connection between what Daniel has done here and the statement later on. But as always, we come back to what is basic in all the stories we've looked at so far, in all six chapters, I think we can say this. The basic to it all is the truth that God is in control. God is always in control. He sets up kingdoms and he knocks down kingdoms. He sets up and he destroys as he wills. All right, we've looked now at these six chapters. I want now to go back and summarize the three studies that we've had in the light of this conflict of loyalties, because we have three different cases. And I want now for us to think about those three different cases and to see how different people acted in different ways in different circumstances. I'm not going to go through the whole six chapters. Out of the three talks, I'm going to take three incidents. Now in the first talk, chapter one, we have the case of the food and refusal to eat the food and the negotiation and so on, so that they were able to avoid eating food that was offensive to them. In the second section, chapters 2, 3 and 4, I'm going to take the story of chapter 3, which is the three men who refused to worship the god and were thrown into the fire. And finally, in this last section, chapters 5 and 6, we'll take the story in chapter 6 of Daniel's praying against the royal edict and getting thrown into the lions for his efforts. Now in each of those three cases, the man of God handled the situation in a different way. In the first case, there was what I would call a partial negotiation. We saw that in our first night. A partial negotiation, as Daniel negotiated with the chief steward an arrangement which satisfied everybody, so that he was still able to do what he had always wanted to do, and so that he was excused from eating food which he considered against the law given to Moses and by which he himself was bound. That one was met by a partial negotiation, which was a happy arrangement, and there was no head-on confrontation. But in the second case, we find it's met by a flat refusal. That's the case of the three men in the fire. But they flatly refused to start something that they hadn't been used to doing. They were told that from this day on, as soon as the music sounded, they had to worship that idol. And they flatly refused. That is, they flatly refused to do something that they were required to do. In this last story of Daniel, he flatly refuses, but in this case, it's different. He flatly refuses to stop doing what he's already doing, and that is praying to God without bothering about the king or anybody else. He just keeps on praying to God as he's always done. So there is a flat refusal, but a refusal to stop. Now, how were these refusals or negotiations met? Well, in the first case, we find it was met very happily. They managed to work out an amicable arrangement whereby everybody in the royal household, including the chief of the royal household, the dining steward, and Daniel and his friends, were all happy with the arrangement. In the second case, the state prosecutes, and it prosecutes very enthusiastically. Heat the fire 7 times hotter than it was before. That's a reasonable degree of enthusiasm, I'm sure you'll agree. The state prosecuted eagerly. In the third case, again, the state prosecutes. This time it doesn't really want to. And yet it's caught in its own laws. Doesn't want to prosecute Daniel, but what can you do? The king's made this law and he's got to do it. So he prosecutes, but very reluctantly. Now in the first case, there is no ordeal at all. In the second case, there was an ordeal because they were thrown into the fire, but they were acquitted, they were delivered. And in the third case, again an ordeal, thrown into the lion's den, and once again acquitted. In each of the three cases, however, there's a happy ending. It says in all three cases that the people prospered. In chapter 1, Daniel and his three friends prospered. They were 10 times wiser than all the others. Their faces were happier and fatter and more healthy looking than all the others. In the second story, the three men prospered. They were promoted to higher positions in the kingdom. And in our final story, last verse, it says, and Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. How can we summarize these findings? Daniel and his friends realized very clearly that the state, the government, was anti-God. They didn't have to be told that. They also knew it was doomed to be overthrown. We've seen that in several chapters. It was doomed to be overthrown. And yet all of them worked for it. They were all civil servants, you might say. They all worked for the government. They all had a rather pessimistic view of the future of their own employer, if you can put it in those terms. But notice they didn't withdraw. They knew the system was doomed. They worked within the system, but there was no attempt for them to withdraw from the system, to create a sort of Christian ghetto mentality, that type of thing. They were there whether they liked it or not. And what they had to do was to work out a way of living in the system, even progressing through the system, and yet refusing those elements within the system which were contrary to their faith. So when you come to look at this, you find there is no clear rule of thumb that is going to automatically give us a solution to every single problem which arises. Now, we live in a society here where you have things that Christians maybe don't agree with. Sometimes there are cases of social action where there are demonstrations or there are people getting against the government and other things. And the Christian is caught up in a society which is in turmoil. Conflict abounds in our society and we're in it. We don't like it. And we wish it would all go straight and smooth. And it doesn't go straight and smooth. And we find ourselves in these conflicts. We have these conflicts of loyalties between God and our employer. Maybe between God and our friends, or our families, or our club, or the union, or students, or whoever it is we're associated with. We've got these conflicts all the time. We're not quite sure what to do about it. Daniel teaches me that we have to be alert, that there is no easy way out, and that we have to face every situation and deal with it on its merits. Governments are going to vary. Laws will vary. Religions will vary. Social issues will vary. But there's no way that we can be excused from a careful discernment and a courageous action. We simply have to be Christian enough and mature enough, biblically based enough, and with sufficient integrity to stand for what we know it is true. Now, if there is a common element in all of these stories, it would surely be loyalty to God and to what is written in His Word. We've seen that, I think, twice very prominently, where people refused to do things because the things that they were required to do were contrary to clear statements in the law of Moses. Other times there were no clear statements in the law of Moses and they managed to arrange things. We have to have this common element of loyalty to God and to His Word, and we've got to work out ourselves how our faith is going to express itself meaningfully and practically in the complicated social and economic and political situation we find ourselves in. I can't make the decision for you and you can't make it for me or for anybody else. We have to be discerning, and we have to learn how to apply God's word and act as Christians in these situations. What we have to avoid is some sort of stereotype approach, which all too often we're guilty of, particularly in the area of politics, because most people are politically inclined a bit to the right of center or a bit to the left of center. And because we've always been that way, and our parents possibly were before, and everybody else in the church or the club or the office or the factory happens to be this way or that way, so often we tend to just follow blindly without stopping to think. And it's not Christian. If we stand for God, and if we discern these issues, we're going to find at times that we're out of favour with those on the right, and sometimes we're going to be out of favour with those on the left. But if there's one thing we've got to do, it's we've got to get better values than those which blindly dictate a course of action simply because we're traditionally following some political philosophy that has been around for a long time. Conflict is going to arise. There's no way we can avoid it. To opt for some sort of pat solution based on blind following of some sort of traditional rule is not really going to help us. We've got to show people, I believe, that our Christian faith is not just pie in the sky. It's not just something tied up with the four walls of a church building, but it's something that does have something to say on the way Christians can live loyally for God and meaningfully for their fellow men in a society which is in constant turmoil and conflict. Now, we are in this conflict, and we've got these conflicts of loyalties. And if we stand for God, we're going to suffer one way or the other. We may suffer from the conservatives, we may suffer from the radicals. It'll vary from situation to situation, from issue to issue. What we've got to make sure is that if we do suffer, we don't suffer for our own stupidity. We don't suffer for doing wrong. If we're going to suffer, let us suffer for righteousness' sake, suffer for Christ's sake. And I'm quoting now from Peter, as he was writing to Christians who found themselves in a very difficult situation where there was conflict and disorder and chaos in society, anti-Christian elements everywhere. And he said, look, if you suffer for doing wrong, there's no credit in that. But if you suffer for doing right, and you take it patiently, then you have God's approval. So, to conclude, let none of you suffer as a murderer, or a thief, or a wrongdoer, or a mischief maker. But if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but under that name, the name of Christ, let him glorify God.